The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from KHUH LP 104.9 FM Seattle, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day, you turned on your radio, and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids, the thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee!
Enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Tonight on CNN, Anderson Cooper examines a nation in turmoil with a giant panel of ill-informed dumb people talking over each other from behind an enormous gleaming glass and stainless steel horseshoe-shaped desk, while swirling graphics you can't quite read float in the background behind their yammering, gape-jawed heads. Find out what our panelists are thinking all at once as the occasional good point gets drowned out by a cacophony of paid partisan pundits.
Than you ever have in your little life.
Plus, Anderson takes us behind the scenes with a tour inside Gloria Borger's massive mouth. Anderson Cooper presents a clamor of conflicting opinions and insipid interjected analysis from a cabal of caterwauling cognoscente. Tonight at 9, following CNN Tonight with Drunk Don Lemon.
All right, that was our CNN promo.
Wow. Aren't you glad you have the Thunderbolt? Yes, it's September 6th, 2019. And here's what I'm thinking of this week.
I'm thinking of a number.
Since the fact doesn't seem to be very widely advertised, I would like to first point out that empirical scientific studies have now definitively proven that there are absolutely no differences between the human races when it comes to things like intelligence or capability or ambition or any other measure that actually matters. The only differences between the human races are literally skin deep. All other differences are culturally implanted. Provided with the same opportunities and in the same context African Americans and Asians and Hispanics and Native Americans would perform just as well or just as poorly as white people do. So the heyday of white middle-class home ownership started right after World War II and ended during the Reagan era. If you were a middle-class white person wanting to take advantage of the many opportunities to purchase a home through federal government programs during this era, then it was literally illegal for you to move into an integrated neighborhood. And it was literally illegal for black people to purchase homes in the new, quote, suburbs, unquote, that were created by these government programs. This led to white people fleeing the cities and leaving the inner city to black people, whereupon the inner cities were subsequently left to rot. All of the public monies for schools and roads and services were now out in the suburbs. Black real estate was, of course, worth far less than white real estate. And there were numerous laws, policies, and practices specifically designed to make sure that their properties stayed that way. Now, since I personally consider reparations to African Americans and Native Americans in particular, but to several other groups as well, to be an absolutely vital part of an absolutely vital healing process that this nation very direly needs to engage in as soon as possible. And thus, I am greatly heartened by the fact that reparations are actually being debated in the other Washington. And yes, there is all of the usual ignorance and racism involved in these debates, such as that displayed by the Senate Majority Leader, whom I will not hear name, calling ridiculous the idea of paying for crimes that were committed 160 years ago. As if all of the brutal oppression had somehow just stopped 160 years ago. But actually, in the case of black people, the Emancipation Proclamation merely transformed de jure slavery into de facto slavery. Meaning, they merely traded one form of slavery for another. These new forms of slavery were called things like sharecropping and Jim Crow and vagrancy and so on and so forth. And in many ways, these new forms were even worse than the actual de jure slavery. Because at least during the heyday of slavery, a strong young slave was worth the equivalent of several tens of thousands of dollars. A slave was a very valuable commodity, and he was usually treated as such. Cotton was America's number one cash export from the founding of the country until the 1930s. And black people did most of the hard work to make that happen. At first, as de jure slaves, and then later, as de facto slaves. During the first half of the 19th century, slaves themselves represented the single most valuable commodity in the United States. And all of the richest people in the country lived not in industrial Boston, but in the Mississippi Valley.
If you've enjoyed listening to this record, you'll enjoy Folk Songs of the Spanish Inquisition.
Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, don't get the knees up, Mother Brown. That's right. Knees up, Mother, must keep up. You must be careful what you do, you fool.
As with most successful livestock breeders and livestock was exactly the legal status of slaves at the time. Slave masters kept their herd well-fed, healthy, happy, and reproducing. Yes, there were notable exceptions to that rule, and none of those facts in any way whatsoever mitigates or justifies anything. But after emancipation, a black man's life soon thereafter became worth next to nothing. If the local powers that should not be needed some slave labor, they could simply round up and arrest a bunch of black men on some pretext and then put them to work. The local powers that should not be thus still got their free labor, but now they were no longer responsible for their health or their upkeep outside the prison. And they were no longer responsible for the non-producing family members, quote unquote. Segregation was illegal until the 1960s. But again, even though legal segregation was ended in the 1960s, we merely traded de jure segregation for de facto segregation. Our country is still very thoroughly segregated in housing, in education, in culture, in worldview, and in pretty much every other way imaginable. Over the centuries, blacks and Native Americans in particular, but along with other notable groups, such as Chinese, Irish, Italians, Jews, many others, have been beaten, lynched, raped, burned, legally oppressed, treated as third-class citizens, denied the right to vote, denied the right to marry white people, denied education, and most importantly, they have been deprived of the ability to accumulate wealth. The equivalent of many trillions of dollars with a T have been stolen from blacks and Native Americans in particular over the centuries. And this theft
and even more importantly, the intentional deprivation for any opportunity to ever accumulate any actual wealth for those groups thereafter. This was a systemic effort that was not conducted with the enthusiastic support of the United States government. It was instead conducted largely at the insistence of the United States government. Their official written policy at the time not only encouraged segregation, but they actually made desegregation illegal in any government-funded housing programs. The official underwriting manual of the Federal Housing Administration at the time stated that, quote, incompatible racial groups should not be permitted to live in the same communities. Most of these policies were, in fact, codified and strictly enforced by the Federal Housing Administration. And the infamous term redlining also came into being during this period, when the federal government began drawing color-coded maps of every metropolitan area. Those maps were first used by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, then the Federal Housing Administration, and then even the Veterans Administration. These color codes were designed to indicate where it was safe to insure mortgages. And anywhere that African Americans lived, or even anywhere that African Americans lived near, these neighborhoods were color-coded red to indicate to appraisers that they were too, quote, risky to insure mortgages. The underwriting manual of the Federal Housing Administration also recommended that highways would be a good way to separate African Americans from white neighborhoods. It is also important to understand that this was not a matter of a law, but a matter of regulation. But since it wasn't hidden, it cannot be claimed that this was some kind of de facto situation, as regulations published in the underwriting manual are as much a de jure unconstitutional violation as something that is actually written into law. Public housing was yet another example of how government policy set out to ensure segregated cities. Believe it or not, at first, public housing was meant to be an affirmative action program for white people. During the Depression, there was virtually no housing construction going on, since middle class and working class families were losing their homes when they became unemployed, and so there were many white families in dire need. And this was the constituency that the federal government wanted to help. And thus, they began a program of building whites-only public housing in cities across the country. They also built a few projects for African Americans as well. But those were, of course, completely segregated. The problems arose when the white projects started having large numbers of vacancies, while the black projects began experiencing long waiting lists. Eventually, that fact became so conspicuous that the public housing authorities and the federal government opened up the white designated projects to black people. This happened at the same time that industry was leaving the cities and blacks were becoming poorer in those areas, and the projects were thus transformed into projects for poorer people rather than for working class people, and they then became subsidized when they had not been subsidized previously, and thus transformed into a welfare program. And that was how the inner cities were eventually converted into the slums that we have come to associate with public housing today. And here is another very important fact that everyone involved in the reparations debate needs to be aware of. Today, African American incomes, on average, are about 60% of white incomes. Yet actual African American wealth is only 5% that of whites. Now that insane paradigm a direct result of these very intentional policies that were implemented by our federal government. Most of the middle-class families in this country gain their wealth from the equity that they have in their homes. And this enormous difference between a 60% income ratio and a 5% wealth ratio is almost entirely attributable to federal housing policy implemented throughout the 20th century, and especially with the New Deal and the related post-war economic boom that was largely generated by middle-class white people spending all of the money that they were making during that period. African-American families were legally prohibited from buying homes in the suburbs in the 1940s and the 1950s, and even into the 1960s. And thus, they garnered none of the equity appreciation that middle-class white people were able to pass on to their children. And yet another thing about all this is that all of these homes middle-class white people were buying in the late 40s and 50s sold at about twice the national median income and were thus affordable to working-class families with an FHA or a VA mortgage. At that time, African Americans were also able to afford those homes. But as mentioned, black people were legally prohibited from purchasing them. And today, those homes sell for 6 to 8 times the national median income. Meaning that while black families could have afforded them back in the day, by the time housing discrimination was made, quote, illegal, unquote, meaning the end of de jure segregation, those homes were now no longer affordable to the families that could have afforded them when all of those white people were buying into those suburbs. Or the beginning of de facto segregation. And thus, blacks completely missed out upon the opportunity to garner all of the equity and all of the wealth that followed from all of that home buying that was going on during that period. Those white families sent their children to college with those home equities. The white working class of that generation was not only able to take care of their own parents in old age, but they were also able to bequeath wealth to their children rather than depending upon those children and or upon welfare and or upon Social Security when they retired. Whilst none of those advantages accrued to any of several oppressed racial minority groups. No, Mr. Senate Majority Leader, the crimes did not stop in 1864, and we owe them a hell of a lot more than whatever token pittance the politicians are considering putting on the table. So just think of how much boomier that boom would have been had African Americans and Native Americans and Hispanic Americans also been allowed to generate the many contributions that they could have made outside of a performance stage or a sports arena. For you see, that is the thing about oppression. The loss of all that potential costs all of us. It's time for a quick station break now. So don't worry, the Thunderbolt will soon return. Or maybe you should worry about that. See you in a minute. The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views, and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of KHUH-FM, nor anyone that has anything to do with KHUH-FM. And now, back to the Thunderbolt.
I'm from the Australian government. Do you have something to hide? Nah, just kidding. We're not some fascist regime. Seriously though, do you? Unfortunately, encryption makes it hard for us to spy on you these days. So just to make sure, we're introducing yet another law to expand the surveillance state. Introducing the Assistance and Access Bill, or ASACCESS for short. Oh, relax. Despite how it sounds, we're not trying to access your data through your back door. We're just after the keys to your front door. Yep, ASACCESS will force tech companies to do our dirty work for us. For example, by making them insert a little secret sauce in their apps, which lets us access your device once you download the latest update. And if they refuse, we'll find the shit out of them. ASACCESS. It doesn't break encryption, only your trust in your favourite apps. To bring you ASACCESS, we've taken the UK's fascist spying law and made it even more fascist by removing any need for judicial oversight. But don't worry, we promise to only spy on you if reasonable and proportionate. And you know you can trust us. We're the same cunts who doxed a welfare recipient for criticising us, who are prosecuting a whistleblower for exposing our misconduct, who throw kids in concentration camps for seeking asylum, and prosecute the journalists who report on them, and who gave $500 million of your tax dollars to a foundation full of our friends. So of course you can count on us to be reasonable and proportionate. And if we're not, well, you'll never hear about it. Because we've also introduced a 10-year jail sentence for any Snowden wannabes who disclose our abuse of ASACCESS. ASACCESS. Brought to you by Australia, where the laws of dickheads can't trump the laws of math, but they can trample human rights. Which is why to test this shit fuckery, we chose Australia, the weakest of the Five Eyes Alliance, thanks to our lack of a Bill of Rights. So international data requests will now be funneled through us, compromising not just Aussies, but all of you fuckers too. You're welcome. We'd love to know what you think of ASACCESS, so we've set up a public submission system where for a limited time, you can protest our next step towards a fucked up dystopia. Australian government. Relax, we're not after your dick pics, just the last shreds of your civil liberties. Authorised by the Department of Home Affairs.
Pairs.
All right, and we're back. So in the first half of the show, we covered racism. Let's start off the second half with sexism. It turns out that female Uber drivers make 7% less per hour than male Uber drivers do. Right. And if that fact actually surprises anyone, then said surprise is probably due to how small that pay gap is compared to the overall population at large. Especially since several members of the upper Uber management recently had their asses handed to them by Me Too, who sent those sexually predatory asses packing. Well, it turns out that in this case, that gender pay gap is not Uber's fault. Now, that doesn't mean that Uber is actually really nice, or that you would want your daughter dating Uber, but we cannot be laying false blame even upon such a deserving target. And it turns out that Uber's dispatch system is literally gender neutral. Neither the computers nor the dispatchers know the gender of any given driver. In addition, since Uber drivers are famously non-unionized, then that pay is the same for all Uber drivers, based strictly upon their performance. And that pay is not negotiated, which means that Uber's pay system is also gender neutral. So what's up with that pay gap? Since large-scale gender-neutral systems are so rare, researchers eagerly descended upon Uber's numbers and records and researched that very question. And here's what they came up with. About a quarter of that pay gap is due to the fact that men work in the more lucrative areas of town. And part of that fact is due to the related fact that yet another quarter of that pay gap is due to the fact that there is much more turnover amongst female drivers than there is for male drivers. And the more experience that an Uber driver has, then the more tricks and shortcuts they learn, including the ability of figuring out where the better paying areas of town are. And thus they tend to become much more efficient with their time. And third, this fact is going to make misogynistic sexists the world over celebrate and rejoice. Fully half of that pay gap is due to the fact that men simply drive faster and more aggressively than women do, and thus get there faster. And yet, in spite of that, women still get into more accidents per mile than men do. And so, the woman driver stereotype turns out to have a little more substance than just some baseless, sexist bullshit. So I guess I will need to add that to my short list of things wherein men are superior to women. For instance, men are better than women at being boy toys. Men are better at retrieving things from tall shelves.
And men are better at kicking people's asses. And now, evidently, men are also better drivers than women are. That's all I've come up with so far, though. In pretty much all other fields, us dudes had probably still better watch our backs, or I suspect that we're likely to become somewhat evolutionarily irrelevant sometime in some not-so-distant future generation. In 1988, the National Rainbow Gathering of the Tribes was held in Southeast Texas. Now, I had been to Southeast Texas. Texas, in fact, has a rather legendary place in my personal reality, in that after having traveled all over North America more times than I can count, with the notable exception of Austin, I consider the entire state of Texas to be my very favorite place in the whole world to not be. I was not the only one to predict that if the gathering were held in Texas, the Texans would start shooting hippies. However, in 1988, the United States Forest Service pulled out all the stops to stop the Rainbow Gathering. I attended the seed camp that year, and there were more Texas state troopers at the seed camp than there were hippies. However, there were also more reporters at the seed camp than there were hippies. For as a result of our epic battle, we were front page news in every newspaper in Texas for the entire month of June that year. And as a result of all this publicity, what the locals saw was us standing right up to the feds and spitting in their eye. And it turns out that Texans evidently hate feds even more than they hate hippies, because they were loving our shite. I personally saw one local, complete with a 10-gallon cowboy hat and rhinestone-encrusted cowboy boots, get right into the faces of the state police at one of their roadblocks, asking them, "Where the hell is your Texas hospitality? These folks are our visitors. Didn't your mama teach you any manners?" So I have attended 13 National Rainbow Gatherings, and never have the locals been more warm-hearted, friendlier, more generous, and more supportive than those people in Texas were. So most of you probably have a stereotype of Tea Partiers and Trump supporters. I suspect that while it would certainly be possible to find representational examples of such stereotypes, I also suspect that on the whole, many of those people might surprise you. I actually attended 2 Tea Party rallies during their heyday. The first was attended mostly by working people who seemed more scared than angry, and I had a lot of very interesting conversations with several of them, and I think I even opened a few eyes of a couple of folks that had been seeking some answers that made sense. The second Tea Party rally I attended, though, reminded me of a 5-minute hate from the novel 1984. It was a bunch of angry white suits screaming hatred and bigotry and blaming school teachers and unions for all of our ills. The Tea Party was eventually bought and paid for, but especially at first, there was actually a massive grassroots push behind it. And I suspect that we have a lot more in common with a lot of Tea Partiers, as well as a lot of Trump supporters, than either side realizes. And it would be really good if we could all get together and work together against our common enemy. So that's it for the news and commentary section this week. And that means it's time to get to work. Ah, yes. And for Seattle listeners, it's time for some music. We're going to go with an old 60s, 70s band called the James Gang. And they ride again. Here we go.
We'll be right back.
that was The Bomber, number 4 medley. And before that, what did we have? We had Funk, number 49. Both of those tunes from the James Gang, featuring Joe Walsh. And that's it for the Thunderbolt. We'll see you next week. Peace. The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt. Nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com. And we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day. And a quick note here. The Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes. Or you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net. Where you can also find the show notes, as well as a year's worth of downloadable episodes of the Thunderbolt.
Thank you very much.